Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
This is Mitchell Davis, host of Taste Matters. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
And welcome to yet another episode of Eat Your Words. We're broadcasting live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn, to bring you all the best in words about food and maybe even some food about words. So we're in the gooey nugget center of summer right now, or as I should say for this episode, the pit of summer. And that means that fruit is everywhere, as you've probably noticed at your local farmers markets, apricots, peaches, plums, berries. This is the moment for them to shine, and you know, for us East Coasters, it's all too short-lived. But for those of us who are despairing that fruit season is slipping through our fingers, today's guests have proven that every season can be fruit season. So I'm thrilled to welcome Sarah Huck and Brian Nicholson to the show today. Brian is a third-generation farmer and the owner of Red Jacket Orchards, which has been growing fruit for four generations now. And you've probably seen and tasted their fruits and juices at farmers markets throughout New York State. Sarah is a former self-professed fruit hawker, the right cookbook author, and a fellow New York University Food Studies alumni. She also owns Co's Cafe in Brooklyn with her husband, Alon. And Brian and Sarah have co-written Fruitful, Four Seasons of Fresh Fruit Recipes. And yes, as you'd imagine, it's all about fruit. So it's perfect for this season, but it won't leave you hanging the rest of the year. So Sarah and Brian, thank you guys so much for being on the show today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
So first things first, what are you guys eating this summer, fruit-wise? You know, what can't you get enough of?
Well, personally...
Blueberries.
Blueberries, Brian? You're always into the blueberries, yeah. You've been eating a lot of blueberries?
I am.
All right, and Sarah, how about you?
Well, I just bought a quart of the yellow plums. Brian, which variety are... I just bought them at your stand over the weekend, the yellow plums. I don't remember which variety it is, but they're really good. They're sweet. They're just a little tart.
So those are like golden sugars.
Is it the golden sugars? Is that the one that you have? Yes. Yeah. I've been eating many, many of those.
Nice. Yeah. I feel like if you're around fruit all the time, you got to be more specific. Like you can't just shovel it all in your mouth at the same time, which is kind of what I've been doing.
Actually, you can. You can.
So you've both been at sort of, you know, your respective crafts, farming, and writing for a while now, and Brian, Red Jacket is now in its fourth generation of farming locally, is that right? Fourth, fifth?
Yes. Nope, third generation, yeah. And the fourth is kind of in the wings, yeah.
Right, well, you dedicate the book to the first and the fourth, right? So I guess that's, you know, the up-and-comers.
The fourth is, we're weaning them right now.
Right, so I'm wondering what sort of inspired you to write the book now, and what was your goal in writing it?
You want to start with that? Or?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Sorry, Brian. So I was working for Red Jacket Orchards at the farmer's market in Williamsburg about 10 years ago. Actually, this book was a decade in the making. And while I was working there, there were always so many customers that were coming up and asking me, you know, like, oh, what can I do with this? And, you know, we would just sit there all day and just eat it, you know, by the handful, shovel it all in, as you were saying. But I found myself thinking that it was, you know, there weren't a lot of books out there that really educated people about fruit, and definitely not about fruit farming. You know, you'd see some baking books, you might see books about apples in particular or something like that. But the beauty of Red Jacket Orchards was that they were growing so much stuff. You know, they had the peaches and the plums and the currants and the cherries. And I just saw it as an opportunity to really educate people, not just about the fruit, but also about this family that was so dedicated to what they were doing. So that's kind of, so I I came up with the idea, and then I had to sell it to the Nicholson family.
And was it a hard sell, Brian? Or
she did a great job of convincing us that this was something we had to do, and I give Sarah a ton of credit because it really was this project. We kind of say was almost a decade in the making. Sarah's been working on it for quite a while to tell the story, and you know, I think it just came to a point where, like, you know what, this, you know, the timing was right to kind of reflect it. We were, you know, on our 50th anniversary, basically, and we said, you know, what a great opportunity to take some of the things that we've done in the past and you know, all this knowledge that really my dad possesses, and this kind of neat story that I guess we take for granted, but I know people kept saying, encouraging us to tell the story about my grandparents and coming up to the farm and just the kind of generational type of business we are and how we've gotten to where we are in the New York marketplace. And I think the other thing that we were really excited about is when we talked with our chef partners and who are really customer of ours for, you know, decades, coming up, bringing their carts to the our green market stall and all that, when we kind of talked to them about the project, the level of excitement that they had for it as well, you know, really kind of like encouraged us on.
For sure, yeah, and that actually that leads right into my next question, which is that Daniel Hume, chef and owner of one of the best, if not the best, restaurants in New York. I mean, that's to be disputed on other shows, but chef owner of 11 Madison Park says in his opening for the book that your stone fruit in particular is inspirational. So I'm wondering, sort of, how you felt when you read those lines, and you know, getting feedback from other chefs. You know, what do you think it is about your fruit, or if you want to be more democratic, just fruit in general, that really gets chefs and, you know, home cooks and eaters so inspired or excited? You know, what have you noticed about fruit?
I think it's a little bit of everything. I mean, I think part of it is, you know, just kind of like one of those pivotal moments in the local food movement. You know, I mean, we're a part of that fabric. We've been selling in the markets for, you know, almost two decades now, and I think part of that just translates through to the relationship that we've been able to create with the chef and the chef's dedication to local farms like our own. So it is beyond Red Jacket, and it kind of even is beyond fruit, I think, why the excitement level and the collaboration was so ready at hand. And I think Sarah and I think we consider ourselves fortunate that part of the excitement was that because we have so much product to work with, at least here, you know, especially at Red Jacket, we go year round, you know, that we're in the markets. And I think that's kind of the inspiration of the book, you know, is that, you know, you can have all this fruit, and whether you're here in New York or even wherever you are in the country, you know, if you have access to great local fruit and you're working with fruit year round, this book really kind of tells the story of helping you utilize it throughout the season. I think that was part of the process. But, you know, with Daniel Hume in particular, he was such a great person to work with. His excitement is infectious for us too. And even, you know, a lot of the other chefs like Dan Barber and all who helped contribute to the book were, you know, we were excited to have the opportunity to work with them, and that they're excited to have our product and local products in general.
Yeah, and I think also, like, one thing that's really special about working with local fruit is there's just so much bad non-local fruit out there, you mm-hmm. know? I mean, like, if you buy apricots at the supermarket or blueberries a lot of times, unfortunately, or, you know, strawberry. I could go on and on and on. It can be really difficult to find fruit that really tastes like the essence of what that fruit is supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And so when you find a farm like Red Jacket, where you can really just like kind of feast both your eyes and your appetite on all these things, I think for any customer that's really exciting, but for someone who makes their profession in food, you know, it's just, you can't wait to get into the kitchen and work with that. Mm-hmm. And I think also one of the things that really excited the chefs that helped contribute recipes to the book was this idea that fruit didn't have to be just baked goods, you know, because that's always really fun, I think, as a cook, when you can play with the different flavor profiles of food and sort of see where it leads you. I think that a lot of the chefs really enjoy that, like Dan Barber's recipe for the apricot pit panna cotta. Yes, it's a sweet recipe, but he sort of is able to use the fruit in an unexpected way.
Right. Yeah. And I love your savory sort of preparations of fruit. And I think a lot of them are unexpected and sort of fruit does get relegated in a way to people, you know, think about eating it raw or they are putting it in something really sweet. And I'm wondering if, you know, maybe both of you can chime in if there's, you know, a recipe or a couple recipes that really stand out to you as sort of favorites in like a, whoa, I didn't know you could do that, because you were getting a lot of input from chefs.
Yeah. Well, from the chef recipes, like I said, the Dan Barber recipe is always one of my favorite. Karen Damasco has like a great strawberry olive oil cake that's maybe not savory, but I just really enjoyed it. There's a couple that are a little more, you know, traditional uses of fruit and savory. I know that Bill Telepan, he gave a great recipe that was like a radicchio and pear salad. It's so simple. And I think that's, you know, and yet like you look at the recipe and you're like, oh, this is going to be kind of meh, you know, but when it comes together, it's just really delicious. And, you know, the way he plated it and everything, it's just, it really makes you kind of appreciate what the professionals sort of have in their back pocket. Mm-hmm. Just that little something that just puts something over the top without really having to go over the top.
For sure.
So
how about you, Brian? Is there like a family favorite or?
Well, I always like to say they're like your children. It's hard to pick the favorite one, you know what I mean? But, you know, I certainly love the range of the recipes. I have family recipes in there too. So, you know, I can get a little hot water if I actually chime in on one more than another, but I'll just talk in general. Mm-hmm. You know, working with like blueberries and scallops, you know what I mean? Some of the unexpected, I think, combinations are some of the things I love. My wife often jokes when I cook that I never write anything down, so when she actually enjoys a dish, and I'm not saying I always make an enjoyable dish, but when I do, she knows she probably won't ever taste it again, but I did write a few down, and a couple of them are in the book, and one is kind of timely right now is the pork chop and apricot. Mm-hmm. And again, just, you know, this combination of using some fruit in an unexpected way.
Brian, have you made that recipe yet this summer? The pork chop?
I haven't. My wife keeps, the apricots are just coming out now, so I'm kind of like, you know, one of the fun things with apricots is we're one of the largest growers of apricots in the East Coast, and we have about 50 acres, so it tells you there's not a lot of apricots grown in the East Coast, but... The fun part of apricots is when they become abundant, it's just, you know, you're always looking for ways to use them and freeze them and can them. And, you know, I that was really the inspiration behind just throwing them on the grill with the pork chops. But I will be making it soon. Mm-hmm.
That recipe also has, like, just one of my favorite Brian sort of turns of phrase when he talks about, you know, having a truly ripe apricot versus having one that you might find, you know, at a supermarket, an inferior one, and how a ripe one you can pull apart its velvety halves and the nectar percolates up to the top. And you know, it really is true. That's like when you get a perfect apricot, there might be nothing better. It's sweet and it's juicy and it's not fuzzy or tart. You know, it's just, it's perfect for pork chops, I guess.
For sure. Yeah, that sweet savory, I mean, just, it works really well.
Yeah.
Fruit and meat.
Well, it does, because, you know, I kind of keep saying that, like, you know, fruit has natural sugars and natural acids, and those are two really essential components to flavorful, balanced cooking. Mm-hmm. So when you look at fruit and kind of pulling with that yin and yang a little bit, you start to see how much possibility there really is.
For sure. And Brian, sort of going back to what you were just saying about, you know, you guys are one of the only people that grow apricots on the East Coast. The book is divided seasonally. And so I'm wondering if you had an East Coast audience in mind, because there, you know, there are some Americans, like those, you know, lucky Californians or Southerners, that they don't have to contend, or, I mean, they look at local sourcing in a different way. I'm not saying they don't contend with that and they don't value it, but we... on the East Coast have to deal with like these brutal weather shifts. And so I think that sort of is what makes local eating maybe challenging for the average eater, you know, someone who's not deeply connected to food. And so I'm wondering, you know, if that is obviously something you deal with every day, but if that was something you were trying to communicate in the book, and how you sort of, you know, work around that brutal 6 month winter that we just had. Or,
you know, it's a great question. And I think we were definitely very mindful of that, excuse me, going into the book. But I think things tend to follow, you know, whether you're on this coast or you're on the other coast, or even if you're further north or if you're further south, the harvest typically occurs in bands across really the globe. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I think you'll find familiarity in that schedule no matter where you are. It might start at a different timeline, but in many ways you can expect it to kind of roll that way. You know what I mean? Along the fruits that we have. You know, blueberries start in Florida, you know, they started in Florida months ago, and they'll end up in Maine months behind us. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I think people can pick up that book and find the pattern to be translatable in many different areas. And I think, you know, again, I think one of the things that was important to us is that creating a book where it is an easy guide, and it flows and it's fluid with what people are seeing come on in the marketplace. But also, I think there's an opportunity when, you know, look, we're fruit people, right? We want people to eat fruit. We'd love for them to start in our orchard and then to start in our region and then be on our coast. But we encourage, you know, more fruit consumption no matter where you are. And, you know, if you can't get that local blueberry, but you're able to get a blueberry in the middle of winter and you can work with it, then by all means, you know, that's great. We want to encourage that.
For sure. Yeah. So we're actually just going to take a really quick break, but don't go anywhere. We're talking to Brian Nicholson, third generation farmer and owner of Red Jacket Farms, and Sarah Huck, cookbook author, about their new book, Fruitful. This is Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network, and we'll be right back.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
It's Tel Aviv.
Welcome back to Eat Your Words. We're broadcasting live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and we are talking to Brian Nicholson and Sarah Huck about seasonal fruit. Their newish cookbook, Fruitful, highlights just ways that you can eat fruit every possible season. And Brian, you are, like we've been saying, a third-generation farmer. You grew up fruit farming, and you talk at length in the book sort of about your family table and how much happened around it. And I'm wondering sort of how that affected you growing up, and also if you think that Americans or North Americans have lost that culture of sitting down together communally for meals, and sort of how that played into this book and your experience growing up.
Well, I love that question. Yeah, it's funny too, because I think Sarah and I had a debate at one point of what the name of the book should be, and you know, of course, everyone gets input on that. And I think I threw out, you know, how about Around the Table? Because from a story standpoint, that was kind of my inspiration, you know, to go back to those memories of growing up on the farm and, you know, my grandparents and my parents, and how much. Funny enough, when you kind of go back in time a little, what are the things that pop up? And that table kept coming back to me. And I realized, like, what a simple notion that is.
Mm-hmm.
And how easy it is to take it for granted. And I guess, you know, part of, like, I guess going through the process of writing a book, Sarah was wonderful at teasing this out of us, like I said. I mean, and I give her the most credit for being able to pull all those amazing facts out of my dad for like 40 years of growing tips. But I mean, what I realized is we kept, like, you sit at that table, it's the anchor point, you know, and there's so much going on outside with either the family or the farm or whatever, but you always kind of gravitated back to the table. And there was always food as part of that, you know. So I guess I started reflecting as I grew up and got out in the world a little. Well, how particular in our family, and this probably happens in a lot of families, is we always gravitate towards the kitchen, you know, whether mm-hmm. it's a gathering or whatever. And it's not necessarily that gravitated towards there because we were all had our hands in the pot or whatever, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But it just seemed to be a place that my family found very comfortable. And I do think that's something that's missing, you know, or that has evolved. And I actually do think it's maybe one of the things that continues to motivate people when they're looking and buying and selecting their food these days is they're, you know, when they're buying local and you can envision the orchard it's coming from, or even you know the family that you're buying it from in the markets. It's an opportunity to reconnect back to something so simple where food is the anchor of our house. Food was the anchor of the history of this country. You know, we take it for granted right now because, you know, we're really good at making our own food. We take for granted that overall our pricing on food is very reasonable. Mm-hmm. But it comes back to a culture for me that's rooted in a very long-term process. You know, when you plant an orchard, it's a decade-long process. And I think that translates back to just how we do business and how we communicate as a family. And, yeah, that table is a great metaphor for it. And it's something that we do live by today, you know. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and maybe this is a question for both of you, because, Sarah, you are sort of the communicator in some ways. I'm wondering, you know, farmers market interactions, maybe you guys have far more of them than I do, but mine are usually pretty quick and surface level, and maybe I'm asking some practical questions, and I'm just sort of there to like shop, get my stuff. It's mm-hmm. nice to know who's selling it and leave, and I know that some people have longer conversations than that, but I'm sure there's a lot of times that you really don't get to communicate everything mm-hmm. you want to about Red Jacket or sort of these underlying values that you do talk about in the book. So I'm wondering if, you know, people who don't know Red Jacket or those people that just like stop by, get their fruit and leave, what some of those values that you are, you know, wishing you could communicate every time are. You can both sort of chime in.
Brian, I think you should definitely start it off because
okay, sure.
I don't want to speak for the Nicholson family.
I think what's funny is oh, go ahead.
No, go for it.
So I think, you know, I think most importantly is that people understand that we care. You know, we care about the food we grow. We care about the community that we grow it in. We care about the people that work for us and the community we live in. You know, we're rooted in the community. We're literally, you know, with 100,000 fruit trees and 600 acres, in this day and age, you know, with the how easy it is for companies to pick up and move and the fact that, you know, where'd manufacturing go in the U.S., orchards and agriculture and all that, you know, we don't go. We don't leave. We're rooted to where we are. We think very long-term, and that's a sustainable long-term process. And, you know, sustainability for us is more than just, you know, the environment and the protection of it is very important. And we work with, you know, the way we grow is biodynamic, and we use organic, and we use also conventional methods. But, you know, beyond that is the fact that, you know, we have to make sure that decisions we make today are going to pay off 5-10 years from now. And, mm-hmm. You know, with our employees, you know, one thing I love is we have very little turnover in our business. We have employees that have been here, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, and that's a commitment we make to them. And I think it's hard to probably get that when you just step into the orchard or step into our markets, but I'm hopeful that, you know, we're fortunate that you can find our products up and down the East Coast now, especially with our juices, and I'm hoping, you know, that if that's important to people when they select our product, that they feel good about getting not just probably hopefully one of the best-tasting products, but a product that means something to them. So I guess it's a long-winded answer to your This is definitely hard to communicate all of that
to add on to that a little bit, sort of branching off of what you said, is at one point you said that you see yourselves, the Nicholson family sees themselves as being in the nurturing business. And I love that because, you know, it's this idea that, like, you nurture the trees, which then produce food that helps nurture the community and, you know, gives sustenance to their employees, gives sustenance to their family. Mm-hmm. You know, it kind of goes back to the earth again. And it's just like a beautiful way of sort of looking at it, that it's not just like nurturing some farmland. It's really just nurturing everything that food touches.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And I think that's a great point that you made, Ryan, too, about you can't pick up and move. Agriculture is, I mean, we can do it other places, but if we're trying to do it here, it is very much tied to place. And I think, you know, in a lot of buying and selling and, you know, food as a commodity, you lose that. And so I think that's really important to remind people, because us New Yorkers, you know, New York City people don't walk by your orchard every day. And so the fruit is sort of our only connection to knowing that it's, you know, coming from a place not too far away.
And, you know, and honestly, Red Jacket's fruit in particular is really rooted to place because of where they're located in the Finger Lakes region, is a microclimate where they're able to grow these things that other farmers can't grow, even probably, I don't know, 10 miles away. I don't know if that's true or not, but Brian can back that backed up or not.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We're right on Seneca Lakes. So we're in the Finger Lakes region of New York. And Seneca Lake is 700 feet deep, 30 miles long, and 5 miles wide. It's one of the largest inland bodies of water outside of the Great Lakes. And it's the reason it's the wine region. You know, I mean, we're there for the same reason, the incredible fertile soils, the sloping land that drains the cold air towards the lake during frost season. And, you know, apricots in particular are very susceptible to frost. And, you know, it's hard growing anything up here. I mean, I think that's one thing people should understand. You know, growing food outdoors is difficult. You know, I mean, there's a lot of things out to destroy it. Mm-hmm. And you know, we're fortunate to be in the Finger Lakes where we can grow some of these very fragile and incredible pieces of fruit, like green gauge plums, you know, I mean, just some of these amazing, delicate pieces of fruit. And one of the reasons, and I have to give my dad and my grandfather a lot of credit, I always joke we come from a long line of contrarians. you have to be contrarian to survive in an agricultural business where you're not the most largest or, you know, most cost efficient. If you can grow things that people love and you can do it in a small way like we do, then you can be rewarded. And I think, you know, that vision and that kind of risk taking and contrarian nature of my grandfather, my father, my grandmother, etc., is one of the reasons Red Jacket's doing well today. We're proud of that. I'm proud of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I would be. And I know that in the book you get into this a little bit, and so does your dad, that you guys struggled a lot when they started the business, and it wasn't easy, and it's still not easy, and it's, you know, farming is hard. That sounds really obvious, but I think to a lot of people maybe it's not. And I'm wondering sort of what you think can be done to better support local farming, because there is a lot of support, especially around you guys, but I imagine there's a lot more that you see that we could do. So it's a big question, but just sort of one area that you really think could be improved that's sort of lagging to make it easier for farmers to do what you do.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think a lot has changed and a lot has come to support growers regionally and locally, you know, lately, and the support, you know, even that we're getting from the state and the Taste of New York and Pride of New York, and there's certain programs the state provides us that have been helpful. But really, when it comes down to it, it's the consumer. It's our customers who every day make it a priority to select maybe a local piece of fruit, and even if it might cost a little more, and hopefully they're getting a better reward. And I'm not saying it always costs more. A lot of times it doesn't. But I think it's our consumers that are probably the most powerful force there. And we want to thank you and say, keep, you know, keep making a priority. It is a long-term relationship. It's a long-term commitment. And we need that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Although I imagine, like, the framework around how you get your fruit here or how much you're able to grow, you guys seem to have really, you know, figured out a system that works. But are you seeing maybe other farmers that are having a tougher time? Like, do you see other people that aren't able to sort of access the market or get that consumer support that you guys have through the green markets and through selling in New York?
Well, I think the market support has never been stronger. I mean, with the number of farmer markets across the nation up, and I think retailers doing a much better job of helping support us, and because the consumer is demanding it, is important. But, you know, I think each grower has to make a decision on what's important to them. You know, standing in a market takes a lot of investment on the grower side. And, you know, part of it's just, you know, making sure if that's a priority for a grower to focus on that, then be the best at what you can be the best at. Mm-hmm. And if you want to grow more in larger quantities and you can't stand in front of it, understanding what your consumer wants is the most important thing, so that we, you know, we can keep it growing as an industry and delivering value to, you know, our customers. And that value is not just great tasting fruit and vegetables and healthy product that's more accessible to the schools and the institutional buyers, but, you know, also, you know, that protecting our watersheds, et cetera. You know, it's a group effort. And, I think we're in a good place in New York, to be honest about that. And even New Jersey and all. So.
Mm-hmm. It's good to hear. I'm glad we are. It's not all doom and gloom. But you and your family, Brian, have been in the fruit business for, you know, over 5 decades. And even you, Sarah, you've been in the fruit business for, you know, at least 5 years. And I imagine that a lot has changed, but I personally don't know too much about that landscape. I know a lot more, hear a lot more about sort of meat production or dairy production, mm-hmm. how drastically that has shifted. But I'm wondering both of you, more the long range view, and even in the past 5 or 10 years or so, what you've noticed has shifted, and then if there's anything that's stayed the same, been consistent, that as well.
Well, I've actually had the pleasure of watching Red Jacket really flourish over the last almost 10 years. I mean, they were nice and strong, you know, local market when I met them, but I've really just seen people learn to appreciate what they're doing, and that's been, you know, a great joy for me, and I'm sure for the Nicholson family too. And personally, just, I don't know nearly as much about the fruit farming landscape as Brian, but I have just, as a consumer, noticed a large increase in the varieties of, even within types of fruit. You know, there's just more varieties and interesting varieties of apples and pears and plums and everything, which it's exciting, you know, because mm-hmm. I think a lot of the varieties just offer different flavors and more chances for people to get excited about cooking and food grown around here.
For sure. And how about you, Brian? What have you sort of noticed shifting?
Well, I'd echo what Sarah said, and you know, I'd probably add this. I think the local food movement is reaching some stage in its life cycle, right? And I think what became clear to me, especially through the recession and all that, is people had made this a really important thing. They care more now. I remember as growers, we were always saying, customers don't know where their food's coming from, and they don't know anything about seasonality and all that. And I said, you know what? For the most part now, customers do. Mm-hmm. And customers are trying to learn more. And that engagement with the food, engagement with health, mm-hmm. is great for us as a country. It's great for us from an economic development standpoint. It's great for our kids. I mean, I have 3 kids under the age of 9 and under. They all just had birthdays this month, so now it's 9.
Happy birthday.
Because we have fruit there all the time for them, which you could probably expect, right? I didn't grow up eating a lot of fruit myself, mm-hmm. but my kids love it. And every night they have an apple, and fruit is the treat. And you could see just the way it's being introduced in their life, that if our next generations of consumers, really, this is an important thing for them, that the demand for fruit and hopefully the health and nutrition of our country will only improve. And through that, because if we're growing it here and if we are becoming manufacturers of food and you know, the value-added portion of it, that's great for economic development. So it's a win-win-win. And I think Red Jacket, we've been able to kind of experience that. I mean, we're now shipping our juices, proud to say, across the country. And it's because we learn through standing on the streets of New York what's important to our customer, you know, flavor and the purity of it. And it's being demanded across the country, and that's exciting for us. And we're growing jobs and all those things that are just, as a business owner, important, you know. But even for health and nutrition and wellness and the nurturing of our community, you know, that's what growers do every day, you know, and we're just part of that, and we're proud to be a part of that, and hopefully we represent that well. And, you know, when it comes back to the cookbook, we're happy to have a chance to kind of put that out there in that format and hopefully create a book that people find engaging.
Mm-hmm. And creates kids that are excited about fruit.
Yes.
that's the dream. That's a worthwhile goal right there for a cookbook.
And, you know, and one of the things that you said, Talia, about, you said you feel like you know more about meat production and, you know, maybe vegetable farming or dairy or something. One of the things that I really loved about the book was the way it sort of gave that behind the scenes feeling of what's happening in the orchards at every point along the season. You know, sort of, this is what happens in the springtime, this is what we're doing, you know, we're waking up the farm, we're turning over the earth, we're kind of doing all that stuff, so all the way through the harvest season and even into the slower winter months. So if you want to know what it's like to own a fruit farm, now's your chance.
For sure. Well, we're out of time, but I want to thank you both so much for being on the show. Again, that was Brian Nicholson, the owner and third-generation farmer of Red Jacket Farms, and Sarah Huck, the co-author of Fruitful, Four Seasons of Fresh Fruit Recipes, available now. This has been another great episode of Eat Your Words. I'm your host, Talia Ralph. We're broadcasting live on Heritage Radio, and we will see you guys next week.
Thanks.
That is great. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.